I'm going to be talking today about the optical view of galaxies at redshifts greater than 1. Part of what I'm going to be talking about is work that's been done by the group I'm part of. The principal other collaborators in this are Chuck Steidel and Alice Shapley at Caltech, Max Bettini at IOA, and Mauro Giavalisco and Mark Dickinson at Space Telescope. So I figured what I'd do is slowly work our way back in time from redshifts of about 1 to redshift 5, the highest redshift where galaxies have been observed, spending time at each redshift that's roughly proportional to the amount that we know about galaxies there. But I should start out with two basic and important facts that really affect the way observations are obtained and how they're interpreted at high redshift. The first one is that, of course, the optical light that we see from high redshift galaxies was emitted in the far ultraviolet. What this means is that what we're seeing is really the young stellar populations. It's telling us about the stars that are forming. We don't know all that much about older stellar populations. It turns out this is in some ways a happy circumstance, because if you plot the co-moving star formation density as a function of time, it looks something like this. It was much higher in the past than at the present. So most of the star formation in the universe, it looks like, happened somewhere here, redshifts 1 to 4 or 5. And so star-forming galaxies are probably what you'd want to study, at any rate, at high redshift. This fits the Z of 4 observations from Steidel et al. It's consistent with flat, but the best guess was slight decline. Okay, the other fact that really affects the way observations are obtained is that foreground populations totally dominate the number counts. If you want to find high redshift galaxies, you have to go to selection strategies that are slightly more complicated than traditional magnitude-limited surveys. To illustrate this, I've made the following plot, which shows about a 2 arc-minute patch of one field, and you can see the galaxies in it. Circled in red and blue are galaxy candidates at redshifts 1 and 3. Rather than working our way down the luminosity function, starting with the brightest galaxies we see and slowly going down to fainter magnitudes, we've tried to isolate ahead of time, based on our colors, galaxies that we expected would be at high redshift. You would not get very many of these if you had a traditional magnitude-limited survey. But one consequence of this is that you don't see all the galaxies that are at the redshift of interest. A lot of the galaxies are relatively faint, like this one here. It means you don't have very good colors for them. And a lot of times, a galaxy that ought to match your photometry, your photometric selection criteria, if you had perfect photometry, won't in reality because of photometric errors. It turns out it's hard to do much better than about 70% completeness, even if all the galaxies at the redshift of interest had the intrinsic colors that you're looking for. Of course, there's also the possibility that some of the galaxies at the redshift of interest don't have the colors that you're looking for. We don't know how true this is at redshift 3, but at redshift 1, by comparing with magnitude-limited surveys, we can figure out that only about half the known galaxies at redshift 1 match our selection criteria. So you should remember there is a significant population about as large of galaxies at these redshifts, which we aren't seeing. Nevertheless, by color selection, you can do reasonably well at finding large numbers of galaxies at high redshift. This plot shows the redshift distributions of galaxies selected with various color selection criteria from about redshift 1. There should be also, say, 6 color selected galaxies between redshifts 5 and 6 added on this plot. The selection criteria aren't always perfect. Some redshifts are harder than others. You get interlopers at low redshifts. But nevertheless, if you pick reasonable color selection criteria, you can home in reasonably well on various high redshifts. So after this introduction, let me pick off where David Koo and other speakers pick up where they left off yesterday. When you have magnitude-limited surveys, you find something like this for the co-moving luminosity density at 2,500 angstroms. These cyan points are at the lowest redshift in the Hawaii survey. As you go to higher redshifts, you see the co-moving luminosity density in the ultraviolet tends to increase. And it looks like perhaps also the luminosity function is steepening. This is about where magnitude-limited surveys leave off, and I'll take over from there. Our group has tried to extend this luminosity function at redshifts of about 1 to fainter magnitudes using color selection criteria. Very briefly, our strategy for finding redshift 1 galaxies exploits the Balmer break. If you had a galaxy that's been continuously forming stars, they'd have a spectrum that looks something like this. And so if you obtain G, R, and I photometry, you can pick out a galaxy at redshift 1 by looking for something that's brighter in I than R, and roughly flat in G minus R. The selection criteria we actually use are a little bit flexible. As galaxies get older stellar populations, They become redder across the board. The Balmer break starts giving way to the 4,000 angstrom break. And to some extent, we can still get these galaxies. We'll get things like SB galaxies in the local universe, but if there's something like an elliptical that just isn't forming stars, we're not going to see it. We've obtained spectra for about 700 galaxies that match our photometric criteria at redshift 1. The redshift histogram looks something like this. It's centered at 1.02 and has a width of about 0.1. When you plot up the luminosity function of these galaxies at 2,500 angstroms, this is what you find. Shown here again are the points from Gillian Wilson, Cowie, Amy, Doug Burke at Hawaii. And these histograms show what we get. This green is from a typical field at redshift 1. This turn over here is just due to incompleteness. It's not intrinsic. I've tried to illustrate that by also showing what you get in the deepest field we have at redshift 1. It continues to rise until here we start hitting incompleteness again. It starts to go down. A curious fact about this is that it's extremely steep. If you were to multiply each of these bins by the luminosity in it and try to see how much luminosity density is being contributed by galaxies with different magnitudes, this is what you find. So, again, this is about where our incompleteness sets in. I don't think we've seen a real turnover. It looks like as you go fainter and fainter, galaxies in that bin continue to contribute an ever larger share of the luminosity density. We haven't seen any in the luminosity function at all. So what are these numerous galaxies that are forming stars at high redshift? These are pictures of some of them in the Hubble Deep Field. The largest ones, the brightest ones, tend to look a lot like galaxies in the local universe. This is about 20 proper kiloparsecs there for a lambda cosmology. So you can see we see some large disks at the bright end. But as you go to fainter magnitudes, the typical ones are actually quite compact and small. This plot shows the sizes, the half-light radii we measure for galaxies in this redshift 1 sample. Again, at the bright end, we see a number of large galaxies similar to those in the local universe, but it looks like the overwhelming majority are quite small, with half-light radii below about 2.5 proper kiloparsecs. I think the conventional wisdom, at least among observers, is that large galaxies were for the most part in place at redshift 1, but I'm not sure if this data totally supports that. We certainly see some very large galaxies similar to those in the local universe. But if you work out the co-moving number density of galaxies that are big with a half-light radius bigger than about 2.5 kiloparsecs, it looks like it's about 5 times lower than what de Jong and Lacy see in the local universe. We're, of course, incomplete. We should probably multiply this number by a factor of 2 because we're only seeing half the galaxies. We might be preferentially incomplete for the larger galaxies as well. So I'm not sure if this is really a contradiction. But I think, as a first guess, it's not entirely clear that the big galaxies really are all in place at redshift 1. The line widths, estimated from 3727, of galaxies at redshift 1 tend to be centered at about 70 kilometers per second. The intrinsic resolution of our observations, which I've tried to correct for, is somewhere in here. So for these points, I don't really know exactly what the velocity dispersion is. I can imagine that everything in this bin, for example, should be at zero, or all these should be in that bin. It's hard to know exactly what's going on here. But the median is about 70. I think that's pretty robust. And the distribution, at least in this end, is fairly narrow around the median. It turns out that we don't see much of a correlation at all between the nebular line widths of these galaxies and their luminosities. This shows the line widths as a function of luminosity in various bands from G at the top to R and to I. I think there's almost no trend at all in G. Maybe by the time you get to I, you're beginning to see some trend. But if, say, the line widths were proportional to, if the luminosity were proportional to line widths cubed, say, you'd expect to have about 5 times lower average line width at this end than at that end, and that isn't what's observed. The trend is actually fairly weak. I'm not sure exactly what this means, but I should remind you what we've measured are just the nebular line width. It's not actually the 1D velocity dispersion of the halo itself. You can imagine that we're just observing the inner part of the rotation curve of these galaxies, and their actual circular velocities could be significantly larger than what we see here. if you plot up the number of galaxies at different redshifts in the Z of 1 sample, you find something that looks like this. And the green bars in this plot show the number of galaxies we've observed at each redshift. And the yellow curve in the background shows our average selection function from the sample as a whole. You can see that these galaxies tend to be clustered. They don't follow the selection function perfectly. The scatter around it's larger than you'd get from Poisson noise alone. Turns out, I should say, each of these bins has a comovie size of about 6 by 6 by 25 megaparsecs. If you try to invert these, turn these counts in cells into a comoving correlation length, you find that it's about 3 h minus 1 megaparsecs for lambda cosmology. So it's quite close to what you get for the correlation length of mass at the same time. If you looked at mass fluctuations in each of these bins, you'd get something relatively similar to the galaxy fluctuations. So whatever these galaxies are, it seems like they're relatively unbiased. And if you were to evolve them forward to redshift 0, you'd get a comoving correlation length of about 5 megaparsecs, which is similar to what we see for galaxies in the local universe. Their number density is also similar to galaxies in the local universe, so I suppose it's possible to make a relatively straightforward connection between these galaxies and typical galaxies we see at low redshift universe. Yes. For lambda sigma 8 of 9.9. Okay, so I'll move on to higher redshift now. I'll skip over redshift 2. There's various technical reasons why it's a little bit hard to work at redshift 2. You can't see Lyman alpha yet because it's too far to the blue, and you start to lose 3727. So not a lot is known about redshift 2. I don't think these problems are insurmountable. You might remember from a plot I showed earlier that we have about 150 galaxies at redshifts between 1.5 and 2.5. But it's a much more difficult redshift than redshift 1 or 3, so I'll skip over it and move on to redshift 3, where it becomes relatively easy again to select galaxies. Galaxies at redshift 3 are easy to find because for a variety of reasons, the typical intrinsic spectrum of a massive star looks something like this. There's a strong break at around 9-12 angstroms from hydrogen absorption. As the light from the stars leaves the galaxies and goes to the interstellar material, the Lyman break gets made stronger still. And finally, as the light from the stars leaves the galaxies, it hits the thick, high redshift intergalactic medium, which makes the Lyman break extremely strong. So you can find galaxies at redshift 3 by looking for objects that aren't there in the U filter and that are there in the GNR filters. Compared to the galaxies we find at redshift 1, the galaxies at redshift 3, their star formation rate distribution looks like this. This shows what we find at redshift 1, and this is what we find at redshift 3. So it looks like there are a much larger number of rapidly star-forming galaxies at redshift 3, and we don't see this steep luminosity function that isn't converging. It seems to turn over, and most of the luminosity density is coming from objects in here at redshift 3. No dust correction at either redshift. It's a curious fact that when we look at galaxies at redshift 3, we don't have a large number of observations, but we do have a few measurements of nebula line widths, and it turns out that they tend to fall in about the 70 to 80 kilometers per second range that we see for galaxies at redshift 1. Their typical sizes are also about 1 to 2 kiloparsecs. That's a mistake. 1 to 2 kiloparsecs. And so they appear quite similar in their line widths and their sizes to galaxies at redshift 1. I'm not sure if that's just a coincidence or if it means something. It's hard to get much information about line widths for galaxies at redshift 3 because it's all moved out into the far infrared. And it turns out most of the information we have is really just the luminosities and spatial positions of these galaxies. But it turns out you can learn quite a lot from the spatial positions of galaxies at redshift 3. This plot shows redshift histograms for various fields in our sample. Again, the green bars are the number of redshifts we see at the number of galaxies we see at each redshift, and the yellow is our smooth average selection function for the sample as a whole. Each of these boxes is about 11 by 11 by 25 megaparsecs for lambda cosmology. So, at first glance, these histograms don't look all that different from redshift histograms you might have seen in the local universe. The galaxies seem to fall, and maybe in a few spikes with gaps in between them. But these are different from galaxy histograms in the local universe in a very important way, and that has to do with the size of the comoving size of each of these bins. It's quite large. It's, as I said, about 11 by 11 by 25 megaparsecs. If you were to smooth the local universe on a scale this large, you wouldn't see very, very large mass fluctuations from one bin to the next. Of course, you go back to high redshift, you'd expect mass fluctuations to be even smaller still. To illustrate approximately what you get for the mass fluctuations from one bin to the next, I've made this plot. So I've normalized everything to our overall selection function, which is shown in purple in the background. And you can get an idea for how big the mass fluctuations would be by seeing the fluctuations of the green bars about this smooth purple background. So you can see for an omega-1 cosmology, we expect to get very similar amounts of mass from one bin to the next. If galaxies were unbiased tracers of mass, we'd expect our average redshift histograms to cue very tightly to the average. For an open or lambda cosmology, we'd expect somewhat larger fluctuations of mass from one bin to the next, but we still wouldn't see anything nearly as large as the galaxy fluctuations we've observed. To illustrate that, I've shown here on the size of one of the overdensities that we see. And you can see it's completely off scale. It looks like the galaxy fluctuations we're seeing are far larger than the mass fluctuations you'd expect. Another way to look at this is to estimate the correlation function of these galaxies, which is shown here. It looks like it's reasonably well fit by a co-moving correlation length of about 4 and a slope of minus 1.6. So this is pretty similar to what you see for galaxies in the local universe, even though we're looking back at high redshift where mass fluctuations are far, far smaller than they are locally. So the clear conclusion seems to be that these galaxies can't trace the mass fairly. They must be much more strongly clustered. So what does this mean, that the galaxies don't trace the mass? Why are they strongly clustered? Well, one way to try to answer that is to turn to models for gravitational instability, either numerical models or analytical models. You can have a pretty reasonable expectation of what you would see at high redshift if you assume a cosmology. We're beginning to know what the initial power spectrum looked like. So you have a feeling for what the mass fluctuations might be, and you can ask yourself, well, what sort of objects in the distribution of mass at high redshift would share the same strong spatial clustering as the galaxies we observe? For a long time, people thought, of course, that the probability you'd form a galaxy at any point would just be proportional to the mass density, but that's inconsistent with the observations because galaxies are much more strongly clustered than the mass. We might think maybe galaxies could form in any of the virialized dark matter halos rather than just at a random point where there happens to be mass. But it turns out that's also inconsistent with the observations. If you take the typical virialized object in the simulation, it's far more weakly clustered than the galaxies we observe. But it turns out there is a population of objects that you'd expect that does have the clustering properties of the Lyman-Bright galaxies we observe. Okay. And it turns out that these are the most massive objects which have formed the most massive virialized halos which have formed at that redshift. I've shown them here with the blue circles. As far as we can tell, Lyman-Bright galaxies cluster in a way that's identical to the most massive objects at high redshift. I think this is the favorite explanation for their clustering properties, but it's a little bit unsatisfactory in the sense that all we've measured is the amplitude of the fluctuations. We can say the amplitude is the same, but we don't really know if the fluctuations are in phase with the mass fluctuations. We don't really know if you get a large number of galaxies where you see a large concentration of mass, all we know is that the amplitude is consistent with that idea. One way to test if the fluctuations are in phase is to obtain galaxy redshifts in the same field where you have a quasar forest spectrum. So here's an output of an n-body simulation. You can imagine observing a Lyman alpha forest through this box. You get something like that. You can use the fluctuating Gumm-Peterson approximation to try to turn this into a map of the mass density at each point, and then see if the galaxy fluctuations really are occurring at the same point as the mass fluctuations. So here's the rough idea. You start out with the forest spectrum at some wavelength. You can use the fluctuating Gunn-Peterson approximation to try to turn this into a map of the density at each wavelength. And you can imagine binning up the number of galaxies at each position and comparing it, say, to the bin mass distribution at the same position. When you do that, this is what you find. So this shows an inversion of the spectrum of 1422. I've tried to estimate the mass at each point crudely. I've also shown, so the red points show the bin mass in each of these redshifts. The blue points show the number of galaxies, the galaxy overdensity we observe. So you can see there seems to be some sort of correspondence. When the red points are above the line, the blue points tend to be too, but it's not perfect. Another way to look at this is to plot up is to arrange the fluctuations by the implied mass over density and look at the galaxy over density you see. And this is what you find when you get, when there isn't very much absorption in the Lyman alpha forest, you tend also not to see very many galaxies. It's not so clear when you get to the overdensity side if a lot of absorption in the overdensity in the forest corresponds to a lot of galaxies. It's not totally clear. But I think there is a signal that there, that you do see mass fluctuations and galaxy fluctuations in the same place on average. We need more data to show this clearly. In any case, one of the most robust things we can say from the clustering of galaxies at redshift 3 is that they're unlikely to have evolved into the Balmer Break galaxies we see at redshift 1. This plot shows, the clustering of galaxies at redshift 3. This shows the clustering of galaxies at redshift 1. It turns out that the fluctuations about the mean histogram are roughly the same at redshift 3 and redshift 1, but the bins have very different co-moving size. In this case, it's about 6 megaparsecs by 6 by 25, and at redshift 3, it was about 11 by 11 by 25. So the fluctuations are the same size, but the bins are much smaller at redshift 1. It means that these redshift 1 galaxies are less strongly clustered than redshift 3 galaxies. Gravitational instability is only going to increase the clustering strength of redshift 3 galaxies with time, and so I think this shows pretty clearly that the galaxies we see at redshift 1 are not the descendants of the one we see at redshift 3. This is interesting because at redshift 1 we can observe objects down to forming stars at maybe half a solar mass per year, and so this can place, in principle, pretty strong constraint on the star formation rates of Lyman Break galaxies at redshift 1. I think the conclusion is that they're probably not forming stars very strongly at all. That's the complication. The co-moving abundance is higher at redshift 1, but if we go to the HDF at redshift 3, we reach a similar co-moving abundance, and if we use that correlation length, the argument still holds. Okay, I'll skip redshift 4 and move quickly on to redshift 5. This plot shows the number of redshift 5 galaxies which have been detected as far as I know. They've been detected with a variety of selection techniques which are coded here in color. The majority have been color selected from Sloan, other people. The highest redshift 1 was narrowband selected. There's also a radio selected AGN and a serendipitous galaxy. You might notice the relatively small numbers of galaxies at redshift 5 compared to redshift 3 and 1, and that's because it's much harder to work at redshift 5. Galaxies are intrinsically fainter, the sky background's much brighter, and as a result, it's tremendously difficult to find galaxies at redshift 5. The observing time that's gone into finding this number of galaxies is much greater than what it took to find 1,000 galaxies at redshift 1, and it's less than, but comparable to what it took to find 1,000 galaxies at redshift 3. I'm mentioning this to emphasize that it's probably, with the current generation of telescopes, we're probably never going to get really good statistics at redshift 5. We'll get a handful of galaxies, but I don't think you can expect to see the large numbers that we're getting at lower redshift. But on the other hand, if you return to the plot of co-moving star formation density versus time, redshift 5 is somewhere out here. We can get large numbers of galaxies at these redshifts. We're having a hard time out here, but not a very large fraction of the stars in the universe have formed out here. It's probably not disastrous for our understanding of galaxy formation that we'll have bad statistics out here well into the future. Okay. I'll stop there. Yeah. From W theta, which is quite noisy at redshift 1 because galaxies aren't strongly clustered, the slope is consistent with being the same, but it's not a very strong constraint.
Great. Could you show the picture on the side?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about the small scale power.
This is obviously not from the ground-based sample, but from the HDF.
Oh, yeah, well, this is ground-based. And the HDF, our statistics are so poor, we can't really say much about the clustering.
Has anybody done that again? That very nice thing that you did where you counted the number of multiple objects?
We just did the odd correlation function of the HDF. We found the correlation like until the cortex. But it made me think that that many of the objects you see are essentially what you get if you remove small macro clouds out of the
I noticed that Roger Thompson is there.
Yeah,
but again, with the deep NICMOS data, you can tell whether that's true or not. But with the deep NICMOS data, you can tell whether you're seeing an underlying redder continuum or not. And basically, your conclusion was basically not. Eric?
I was intrigued by the preliminary results on the correlation of Lyman alpha 4 with the galaxies. I noticed that at least so far, the places where you see the biggest clusters of galaxies are sort of average regions for the function. I think that's a chance, perhaps, to find that there's some ionization going on in those types of regions.
Yeah, I mean, the statistics are so poor, I don't think we can say right now. But I it's possible, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's easy to imagine that the fluctuating Gunn-Peterson approximation could break down in the biggest overdensities. Yeah. Again, what we've observed are just the nebular line widths. We haven't seen the maximum rotation velocity. Yeah, it's quite good in the local universe, but it maybe it breaks down at high redshift. What are the descendants? I don't know. If I had to take a guess, I could imagine it's redder galaxies that aren't forming stars, ellipticals.
Carlos?
You also have a question and another question. You say that you seriously imply that it's not so interesting to look at galaxies beyond that one. However, to find the galaxies of that in the ionization is would be kind of.
Yeah, I didn't mean to say it wasn't interesting. I meant to say it's very hard and it'll wait for more.
Carlos, you had.
Yeah, I think that's the explanation.
And you showed the plot of the distribution of transformation based on 1 and 3. Mm-hmm. With that, you have made any calculations?
No.
And you could give us an idea of what size correlation
to expect. At redshift 1, I'm not sure exactly because we don't go quite far enough out in the far ultraviolet to use the techniques that are used locally. At redshift 3, it's about a factor of 7 or so. So it's quite large.
For the most extreme cases?
No, for the typical case.
So you think 7 is not typical?
Yeah.
But would you change the curve? You would change the curve dramatically for that?
Yes. Yeah. On the power law part, it just shifts over at the exponential part. It's more complicated. Yeah. It might take me a while to find it. Maybe we should.
Yeah.
there's going to be a long discussion section at the end of these three talks. So I just noticed a lot more hands going up. I think we'd better move on to Amy Barger's talk.